This is the Socialist Caucus presentation, and we want to encourage all of you who are here, who enjoy this kind of content, to stay in communication with us, because we like to think we put on some of the broadest, edgiest, most important socially important sessions at APHA. And we can't tell you about the good things we're doing if we don't have a way to communicate. So we'll ask you to sign in for us, because APHA counts heads, and that matters to us in terms of our ability to get a good-sized room and other things along that line. It also matters to us because we want to be able to get an email to you next year before our program to tell you about the things we're doing. And lastly, if you have research yourself and presentations yourself, which cut across the issues of women's health, social justice, corporatocracy, healthcare justice, we'd love to put your presentations into our program. So if you're involved in those sort of activities, you can't communicate with us unless we can communicate with you. So please sign in and put your email address on here. We promise no more than one, maximum two emails a year. And we'll not share.
That's important. We really don't send out more than about two emails a year. Okay, so welcome to our session, Environmental Justice, Organizing for Real Community Participation. And it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, whose work I use with my students at SUNY Old Westbury, and that is Dr. Meredith Minkler from the Department of Health and Social Behavior at UC Berkeley School of Public Health, where she is not only professor, but director of health and social behavior at the School of Public Health, where she founded the UC Center on Aging. She's done lots of research I won't tell you about, but I will tell you that the book that I was referring to was a real pathbreaker in this area, and that and she's now got the third edition out, Community Organizing and Community Building for Health, and I see that in the third edition it's for health and welfare, a word that's gone out of fashion, but we think that we should use it more. Dr. Meredith Minkler.
Thank you. That was very nice. I have a quick question. Is there anyone here who doesn't know the basics of community-based participatory research or needs a little two-minute refresher? Okay. In that case, I'm going to skip over the first few slides and get right to the content. But I do want to leave this one. I am very glad that some people still call themselves socialists. So thank you. And to the caucus. Okay, so this is the rationale for CBPR, and I will skip over the definition, the wonderful principles that Barbara Israel and Amy and their partners at University of Michigan came up with. I do want to mention cultural humility, because this often isn't talked about. But I think it's important to add that we can't ever be competent in another's culture, but we can show an absolute commitment to self-critique, to redressing power imbalances, and developing high-level partnerships. And that is so important given the continued distrust of outside researchers. Just recently, I've been working with a community partnership in East Oakland, and one of the partners said, you know, you researchers are really the undocumented workers. You come in, you grab what you need, and you leave. So that stays with us, and we have to disprove that that is our way of being. CBPR, of course, occurs on a continuum. I'm going to argue that for achieving distributive and procedural justice, we need to be at the far end, what we call the gold standard of CBPR. And policy-focused CBPR is really my interest, and I know of that of a number of you in the room, which is concerned in part, of course, with distributive justice. And that refers not just to what we normally think about, fair distribution of exposure to social and fiscal environmental hazards, but also the resources for living, the things like access to full-serve grocery stores, good places, safe places to work and play and live. And we often don't talk about that part. And finally, procedural justice, getting a place at the decision-making table and getting to stay at the table and help make the decisions that affects one's life and one's community. And one of the people that I most respect in really hitting home on this is Peggy Shepherd, who I am going to just give credit. Peggy, are you still here? Peggy, okay, yeah, just stand up. Peggy is really my outstanding model of doing policy-focused CBPR and getting to action. And so I put this slide up. Her partnership with the Columbia Children's Center for Environmental Health started 15 years ago. It's still going, and they've achieved all kinds of wonderful results. They also have one of the best websites, so go to their website and check this out. But in the very beginning, Peggy approached Columbia about her community's concern that the high levels of children's asthma in that neighborhood was in some way connected to the fact that 7 out of the 8 diesel bus depots were located right in their community, 650 Port Authority buses, all these other polluting facilities, and not coincidentally a community that was largely African American and Latino. But this is what I wanted to get to. The goals that they set out for that collaboration 15 years ago were, number one, having to do with distributive justice, studying the relationship between community-level environmental exposures and environmental health outcomes, and secondly, translating the findings into policy change and creating equity in environmental decision-making. And I don't know about you, but I wasn't hearing that term equity very much 15 years ago. Peggy has always been way ahead of her time. Well, CBPR also obviously can improve the cultural sensitivity and the reliability and validity of our survey and other measurement tools. And I don't know if Amy will be giving an example of that. But I wanted to mention something that is less widely known, and that's how community members can contribute to ground truthing, even if you're using things like government data sets, which are good to use, because then when the opposition turn around and say, oh, your data is flawed, you can say, it's your data, CDC or State Health Department or whoever it is. So one thing that community partners can do very well is to verify the location and the accuracy of information on air and water and other forms of pollution, and also sensitive receptor land uses. And these are things like the presence of a daycare center, a nursing home, a school in an area. And they can also locate and map additional air and water quality standards because they know the community. They know what's there. They know the things that aren't getting picked up on the top-down models. So this is just one example from Southern California. All of the little yellow areas there are air quality hazards that the community picked up that were not on the state database. And that made a big difference in terms of going forward and demanding some policy change. Another advantage of CBPR, of course, is that it can help with the real-time dissemination and translation of research findings. One of my favorite examples comes from the West Oakland Environmental Indicators Project, which is a nonprofit that partners with Pacific Institute, more of an academic think tank. West Oakland, for those of you not from the left coast, is an area with 25,000 residents. We have one of the largest ports in the country, and so it's a very popular destination for trucks, bounded on all sides by freeways. And the early research of this partnership showed asthma rates for children under 15 7 times the state average. They also brought in outside experts to train the community members on how you do truck counts, and I figured that would just be numbers, and it really isn't. It's very complicated, axles and all sorts of things. But they did truck counts. They did studies of idling outside the port. They did a lot of air quality monitoring, sometimes using the city hall as the comparison point. And as you can see, they found that diesel particulate matter exposure was 90 times the state average. Just a phenomenal, abhorrent figure. Well, the findings were released in a highly publicized report, got a lot of local press, and their policy goal was to create a truck route that would keep the trucks from cutting through the neighborhood to make it more quickly to their destination. To do this, they partnered with local political figures who were in favor of this with the District Air Board, but also with the Port Authority and with the truckers themselves. And this made for very strange bedfellows. So you can imagine these monthly meetings and some of the tension that would arise. But the nice thing about this is they eventually hammered out a truck route everybody could agree on. It unanimously passed. And they also used the findings for the benefit of truckers. Now, not all my friends in the environmental justice movement agree with what they did, but they did help convince the EPA in California and the Air Resources Board to support a $22 million program that would replace the trucks. And the estimate is that this will now reduce the emissions near the port by 85%. So it's not perfect. It's not getting rid of all the bad trucks, but the truckers are primarily low-income immigrants themselves, and it's a way of connecting those two movements. Well, I love this from Richard Hofreiter, who points out that we in academia have a dilemma. What do we want? Oh, let's see if this works. Evidence-based practice and policy. When do we want it? When do we want it? Oh, shoot. Just a second. After peer review was supposed to show up. Anyway, we obviously do need to publish, and publishing the work is critical, not just for tenure, but also for making change. But I would ask you, what would you imagine would be the more important article to come out of this project? This one that appeared in the American Journal of Public Health, or this one in Oprah Magazine that features Margaret Gordon, a dear friend and the leader of West Oakland Environmental Indicators, and tells the same story, but from her point of view, from the community point of view. WEACT also has done a fabulous job. This is from the very beginning of their work, but they've continued to do a fabulous job of getting the information out there in ways that it reaches the people who can make change. They put up 75 bus shelter ads in the very beginning. They did an alternative fuel summit, public testimony, briefing officials. This continues to go on, press conferences, and one of my favorite things from Peggy Shepherd, toxic and treasure tours. So you don't just show the politicians, this area is a dump, just as you always thought it was. Look at this site of emissions and this one and that one. But you show them the Apollo Theater, and you don't have to be African-American. If you care about jazz, you know that this is a huge cultural icon for our whole country. Hidden Hazards was a very powerful booklet and call to action that came out of that project with the ground truthing in Southern California. See if I can hit the right button here. And I'm not talking about this work we did on the indoor air environment in Chinatown, but we also released a colorful report in three languages and had a huge rollout with 170 people, 20 press people, and four of the city supervisors, and were able to get policy change. So if I have time for one last example, I wanted to talk about the... Do I? Okay. Oh, good. Okay. The potential of this kind of work for translating evidence-based research into sustainable change. You've all heard the expression that laws are like sausages. It's better not to see them being made. I always say in CBPR, we not only need to see them being made, we need to be in there mushing the stuff with our own hands. These are the three streams in the policymaking process that John Kingdon put together. I have found these very helpful in going through and looking at CBPR projects and how they are involved in each of the three streams. But here's the last example I wanted to share. This is Old Town National City, which used to be the vibrant heart of the Latino community in San Diego, California. And then in the 60s, an all-white city council voted to make it a mixed-use neighborhood. All the paint auto body shops moved in, and overnight it became a dumping ground for private industry. The little triangle there, the pink triangle, is the local elementary school surrounded by these toxic polluting businesses. And across the street from the school is a truck driving school that actually will have the trucks go into the schoolyard and practice parking, idling, turning around, coming up during school hours. There was a teacher carried out on a stretcher once during all of this. Just unbelievable stuff. Well, the Environmental Health Coalition is not up there with WEAC yet, but they're a good one to watch. They're an organization that has also been around for many years. Part of what they did was in-house data collection, so they had a MPH person who could do GIS mapping and turn it into toxic footprints. And I think this is a really clever use of data, showing the toxic air emissions in these areas, just in Old Town and then in the three areas closest to it. And this is a small area, so it's really very profound to see that. They also had help from the local USC researchers who would share and make accessible data on the effects of things like diesel exposure on lung development in young kids, but also would gather data for local communities on their own particulate exposure rate. So they were doing that just gratis, just as a favor to the local communities. The community part also came in, though, when trained promotoras were hired and helped to design and conduct a community survey. They went door to door. They also learned to use P-tracking devices to measure fine particulate matter, and they too use City Hall as their comparison site. So when they're presenting, they've got a really nice thing to say to the city council. They did a lot of media advocacy. They would always show up in the hearings very well prepared, and they would all be dressed in their blue Environmental Health Coalition T-shirts, and they would show up early. So they'd be in the front of the room, and these policymakers would come in and couldn't even find a seat, nor could the lobbyists for the other side. Well, the policy outcomes to which this partnership made substantial contributions, and part of this I learned from talking to the policymakers, and I would just ask them, did this make a difference? Did it have a role at all? And they said, absolutely. The ordinance, the amortization ordinance forcing these businesses out after a legitimate period of time, never would have passed. The Old Town became the first municipality in California to make environmental justice part of its general plan, and in 2010 they passed a specific plan so that all new businesses have to be ones that the community wants. They cannot be polluting. They have to be providing goods and services, public transit, and recreation. So it was a very impressive example, I thought. Well, just to sum up, and I'm building here largely on the work of my dear friend and colleague Rachel Morella Frosch, who points out that CBPR improves the three R's of research: its relevance, rigor, and reach. It builds trust through transparency and respectful partnership, and I would add it builds not just community but also outside researcher capacity. I have learned so much from community partners, and I know my partners up here have as well. And it helps translate findings into action for distributive and procedural justice. So let me just add with a quote from one of my favorite partners who recently passed away. But Frank Rose always used to say, I don't think outside the box, I think outside the warehouse. And I think if we're going to achieve distributive justice and procedural justice, we do need to be thinking outside the warehouse, and CBPR is a good way of helping do that. Thank you.